Dragon Variety Podcast presents Episode 8, an interview with author David B. Coe.
I am David B. Coe. I'm the author of 11 fantasy novels under my own name, as well as a movie novelization, the novelization of Robin Hood, the Russell Crowe, Ridley Scott movie that came out a couple of years ago. And I am now writing as well under the name D.B. Jackson, and I'm doing historical fantasy. I have a book coming out in July called Thief Taker. And finally, I am part of the Magical Words blog site, a site for aspiring writers that focuses on the craft and business of writing that I helped to co-found along with Faith Hunter and Misty Masson.
And that is the blog where I found out about David and started commenting on his posts and eventually realized that all of the Magical Words crew, or most of them, were going to be at one of our local conventions. So in fangirl-like wonder, I made my way to the convention. We were going anyway, but we were excited. And so that was really fun to finally meet all of these people whose blogs I'd been reading in person. And Adrian.
Yes. So I was a huge, huge fantasy science fiction buff in high school, have been for years and years and years, and spent inordinate amounts of times at the local library taking piles of books home in picnic bags. being 14, 15 years old and wanting, you know, the dream of being a writer someday, people who had books published in libraries, they weren't real people. They were authors with a capital A, you know, like they didn't really exist. They lived on some special plane of authorness, and their books manifested in libraries. And back in that time, I read your Lon Tobin Chronicles in high school. And so Scribe was on the podcast talking, and she was like, and David B. Coe is going to come talk with us sometime. And I went, wait, you mean like the author with a capital A?
I think she actually said, wait.
I might have just started twitching. Authors that I've become more familiar with as I've been older, when I realize that it's an attainable goal and, you know, they actually exist, don't have the somewhat glowing aura of wonder of the authors that are still authors from when I was 14 or 15 years old. So,
congratulations, you're part of that ranking.
Still just kind of twitching right now, so you'll have to give me a moment. But
okay. I'm feeling old, but I'm feeling.
Yes, see, this is what we do. We butter you up, and then we roast you.
Yeah.
I recently reread the Lon Tobin Chronicles, but I had a couple questions for you because I know that those were your first books.
Right.
And one was, how long did you spend working on those before you managed to get the first one published?
Well, that's a good question, and it's one of those questions I could answer any number of ways. I started writing the book that became Children of Amrit when I was 17 years old. Now, the form that it finally took bears very little resemblance to those first scribblings that I did back in high school.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah.
But I started working on it way, way back, years before I got it published. And then a lot of things happened, and I went in a lot of different directions and ended up with a PhD in history. In between
I
getting
didn't know
my
you were Dr. David Coe.
Yes, that's right, Dr. David B. Coe.
Are we going to start calling you the doctor?
I can't prescribe anything. Yes, I can't prescribe anything useful. I can just prescribe, you know, monographs, which is really not anything fun at all. But so in between the time when I got my degree and the time when I was ready to start applying for academic jobs, I had several months, and I started working on that book. And around the time that I got my first academic offer, I also heard from four books that they were interested in my novel. So there was really, from the time I began working on it in earnest, in a professional way, there was less than a year that passed before I sold the book. But the book needed a lot of work, and it was in production for 3 years
before it finally
published. I had to
run straight from work because it started, like, right after, and I was like, where's my
Wi-Fi? I kind of paid my dues on the back end on that one. It was kind of, I got lucky with an early sale, but then I did a lot of learning and revising and editing and re-revising and re-editing between the time when I sold the book and when it finally saw light of day.
Hi.
Does that answer your question?
Absolutely does.
Okay.
From a writer's perspective, I was curious, which character was your favorite character to write?
Well, that's another one of those. I could answer that a couple of ways. Early on, I thought that my main hero in the book, Jared, was going to be my favorite character because he was kind of me as I wanted to be. I got sick of him really fast because he was too damn nice. He was so boring. He was just so boring. And so by the end of the series, my favorite characters were Oris, who's kind of prickly and obnoxious and much more like I actually turned out to be, and, and Melior, who was the woman he fell in love with eventually. They ended up being my favorite characters because they were, quite honestly, the most interesting characters. They were drawn in shades of gray, and I think that was a sign of growing maturity on my part as a writer, that I was no longer writing these really, really bad guys and these really, really good guys who just make you want to throw up.
It's interesting that you say that because it's really, really clear reading the books since Jared starts out. When I read the first book, I thought he would be the protagonist throughout the whole series because he was your main character. But you can really see it change over the course of the books because it really becomes Melor's and Oris's story in a fascinating way. I want to know, And it's good because you resolved it all, but it leaves me, I definitely want to know what happens next, so I have to come up with that on my own.
I've had a lot of people come to me, a really amazing number of people who have come to me over the years and said, you need to write another Lon Tobin book. And it's one of those things where I feel like I ended the story I was trying to tell, and yes, they go on and live lives, and it's kind of up to my readers to decide what those lives look like. But the main problem is that world feels like one that I've outgrown as a writer. And so going back to it would be, I think, very difficult at this point. As much as I would like to, you know, and my editor at one point mentioned to me the possibility of doing a short story in that world to try to revive the characters, since there were people who were clamoring for more books. And so maybe if I get a short story written, I'll be able to find something that I want to do in larger form.
And speaking of short stories, to make this into sort of a broader question. At Dragon Con, when I said that I don't really write short stories, you gave me the look. No, David gave me a very intimidating look and just said, you must write short stories. Can you explain a little bit of your process with short stories and your theories about short stories?
Absolutely. When I sold novels, I sold 3 or 4 or maybe even 5 novels before I sold my first short story. And throughout that time, I felt as though I had not yet arrived as a writer. Because in my opinion, the short form is really the purest form of prose fiction. And I say that because I think that writing in novel form gives us the leeway to be looser with our plotting and looser with our characterization and to not make our wording and our sentence structure as tight and lean and efficient as it can be.
Crap.
And so,
you've pointed out my weaknesses.
I'm sorry?
I said you've pointed out my weaknesses.
Oh. I still write novels. That's what I do. But I still look at the short stories that I've sold, and I've actually just sold very recently 2 short stories under the name D.B. Jackson that are going to be coming out right before Thief Taker does. And that remains some of the work of which I'm most proud. And in fact, I sent you a story, Scribe, for...
Yeah, indeed. David's story is going to be appearing on our Anne McCaffrey dedicated first issue of the Pendragon Variety Literary Magazine.
Right, and the story is called The Dragon Muse, and it is far and away my favorite thing that I've ever written.
It's a beautiful story.
It really is.
It's a fun story, and it was. I'm not sure. I appreciate that. I'm not sure I think of it as beautiful, but it was really fun to write. And,
I
was laughing the whole way through.
I loved the idea of just having some kind of pressure forcing an author to actually put words out, and that being, you know, actually a life or death situation.
Right. Now, don't give away too much.
I'm not going to. That's all I'm going to say. But yes, everyone can look forward to that. It was a really fun story.
So anyway, I just think that short fiction is, it's more demanding. It requires that we be more exact with our wording. And it also does wonderful things for writers who are working on novels. It gives us a chance to practice our voice for the larger project. It gives us a chance to explore background stories and character events and characters' lives and stuff of that sort. And finally, it gives us stuff to sell. And having a short story sale under your belt when you go to sell your first novel is absolutely a leg up in this business.
Right. Now, speaking about the business of writing and all of that, the way I discovered your writing and quite a few of the other authors that I'm now acquainted with is through Magical Words. So you mentioned before that you and Faith and Misty started up Magical Words. What got you started writing Magical Words? What made you want to start that kind of blog?
It got started at a writer's workshop in South Carolina. I've taught three times now at the South Carolina Writer's Workshop Annual Conference, which takes place every year in October. And for those of you looking for a writer's conference to attend, it costs a little money, but it's a really good one. They get agents and editors and writers every year, and it's a really nice conference. While I was there, my agent was there as well, and she had with her another one of her writers, a woman named Faith Hunter, who I had never met before. And meeting Faith was like meeting my long-lost twin. It was electric. It was just a person who should have been a part of my life from the day I was born, and we just kind of missed each other for the first 40-some-odd years. So we were at this writer's conference. We're already in the mindset of thinking about teaching writing, and we both really enjoy doing that. And we spent an evening drinking beer at a party, talking about finding some way to turn this amazing first day friendship into a project that would keep us in touch with each other. And soon after that, we brought in Misty. Faith had known Misty for a while, and I had met Misty at a previous South Carolina Writers' Workshop. And Misty wanted to be a part of it as well. And so the three of us kind of formed the site as much a project that we could work on together as a project that we could use to kind of pay back the industry that had been thus far pretty good to us. And that was where it started. And then we brought in Katie Murphy, C.E. Murphy, and later we brought in Ed Schubert and Stuart Jaffe and A.J. Hartley, and now Kalena Price is part of it, and we have guest writers appearing once or twice a month, and it's really become kind of a little franchise.
That's really fun, and you guys actually also published a lot of those blog entries as a book on writing.
That's right. How to Write Magical Words, A Writer's Companion. It's available from Bella Rosa Books. Thanks for the plug there. Subscribe. It's a compendium of some of our best posts from the first 3 or 4 years of the site. And it includes some of the discussion that follows. And that's really kind of what makes the book unique, is it's not just essays on writing. It's as close to discussions on writing as you can find on the printed page.
I have another question about the business. You mentioned meeting Faith through your agent when you went to the conference. At what point in your process did you try to find or begin to get yourself an agent? Did you do that before you published your first book? Or was your first book just released directly to the publisher? When did you decide to pick up an agent and add it to the process?
I ended up with an agent almost from the get-go. This was someone who had been a friend of the family, of my family. He had known my parents, and he also had been in the publishing industry. That's where he had worked all his life, and he was at this point retired. But I told him that I was interested in trying to sell a novel, and he said, "Oh, I'll be your agent." And he also said, "And I'll take 15%." So it wasn't like he was doing me a favor. I mean, we had a verbal agreement, but it was a standard professional arrangement that we had. And he shopped my book around, and he absolutely made it possible for me to sell Children of Amrit. As I said, the book needed a tremendous amount of work. And this agent got me in the room when I might not have gotten in the room without having him on my side. Now, I'd like to think that the manuscript sold itself once it was in the room, because publishers aren't into publishing books out of charity. So obviously, my editor saw something there that he thought had promise. But the book needed a lot of work, and I was very, very fortunate to find that agent early on. Now, what happened was, once I was done with the Juan Tobin Chronicle, as I said, this was a gentleman who was retired. He had a long history of health problems, and he was not interested in being the go-getter type agent that I wanted to have as my career started taking off. And so I switched at agents after that first series and went with Lucienne Diver, who was with Spectrum Literary at the time and is now with the Knight Agency. And she has been my agent.
Wonderful.
And so, she writes for Magical Words as well.
She does indeed. Her posts are very interesting and enlightening about the business itself. I have another question about Magical Words. And that is, have you found that meta writing improves your writing, or does it make it harder?
I'm sorry. I couldn't understand the first part of what you said. You said you have another question about
Magical Words and about the process
magical
of writing.
Okay, and what do you mean by meta writing?
So writing about the process. You teach writing through your posts on Magical Words, and a lot of those posts are things like the monomyth. And
right.
And aspects of writing.
Absolutely.
Have you found meta writing? Sorry.
Yeah, breaking down the process. I'm sorry. We keep on stepping on each other's lines.
Go ahead.
Okay. The process of breaking down the creative equation into its component parts is incredibly helpful for me when I'm working through problems in my own work. It's kind of like trying to explain swinging a baseball bat to someone and having to kind of break down the motion step by step by step by step in order to make it clear what you're doing with a much smoother motion once you're done breaking it down. And for me as a writer, it works the same way. When I'm thinking about explaining my character work or explaining the way I plot or explaining the things I do to make dialogue flow, it forces me to slow down in my own writing and see if I'm actually doing the things that I'm recommending to others that they do. And in making myself do that, I find that I often catch myself cutting corners or engaging in bad habits that I'd be calling a writer on if I was teaching that person. I actually mentor a student at Antioch University, Midwest, and there are things that I catch her doing, and then I go back and I look at my work and I say, well, geez, I do that. maybe I need to break this down even further. So yeah, it's really helpful to do that sort of writing so that when I come back to my creative work, I'm thinking about process.
Right. Well, I have another question, but Adrian or Scribby, if either of you have something, you can jump in now.
Go for it.
So, we met you at a convention and had the pleasure of hanging out with you more at DragonCon. Now, you mentioned going to writers' conferences, but did you go to conventions before publishing?
No, I didn't. I had never been to a convention before I went to my first one as a professional, and the one I went to was called Magic Carpet Con, and it was in Chattanooga, Tennessee, and it was held literally 7 days. Oh, no, excuse me, 5 days after the release of my first book in hardcover.
Oh, wow.
So I was as much of a newbie as I could possibly have been. And I was walking through a hotel in Chattanooga, and I turned a corner, and there's a guy in full Klingon battle dress with the little curly pointed toes and the gunk on his forehead and everything, and he's pushing a baby carriage. And I thought, yes, I have arrived.
Welcome to conventions.
This is proof that I have made it as a writer.
That's awesome.
So, do you think it would have changed things for you had you gone to conventions beforehand?
Yeah, I would have run screaming from the genre and never to return.
Okay.
I really don't know. I was certainly an avid reader of fantasy and science fiction beforehand. And so I didn't really know that conventions existed in the form they do. Conventions are portrayed on TV news and stuff like that as kind of Trekkie cons, where people go
right.
to pay homage to poor acting and cheesy dialogue. And what they are, most of the time, is actually something quite different. It's people who want to go meet those who are writing the books that they love reading. And it's a very different dynamic than the way it's portrayed. And so I kind of dismissed cons as something that I would never be interested in, only to discover upon attending them as a professional that, my God, if I'd known they were going on, I would have loved them as a younger man.
Right.
I have another question on a slightly different topic. I think, obviously, as writers, we all spend a good deal of our time reading to learn about our genre, to learn about style, and to just appreciate what's out there. But I think for every writer, there are those few authors, either in your genre or outside your genre, that you really notice something about the way they write, something about their and become really large influences. Well, we're kind of familiar with what some of those named authors and influences are in modern literature, but at the time that you started writing, who were some of the big influences in your work or that inspired you to look at your style or, you know, start taking the journey that you took?
I'm sorry, I'm laughing.
In other words, you're old?
Yes.
Way to go, Adrian. Way to go.
I really wanted to say, well, yes. I mean, my contemporary, Chaucer, he was such a wonderful...
I think that came from...
let's see. When I started reading fantasy with Tolkien. That was the first one. I started with The Hobbit and then followed it quickly with Lord of the Rings. And that made me want to read as much of that stuff as I could get my hands on. And then I read Stephen R. Donaldson's Thomas Covenant series.
Yes.
The first two series. And realized halfway through the first one that I wanted to spend the rest of my life writing fantasy. And I think it was because, I mean, there are things that are disturbing in Donaldson's work, and I know that there are a lot of readers who can't get past certain things that happen early in the first book of the first Thomas Covenant series. But there is a level of creativity and a level of kind of... Thomas Covenant was the first dark hero I had ever read, and I found that fascinating. And I remember reading it and thinking, this is what I want to do. I want to create characters. And then, of course, I go and create Jared, who is like as far from a dark character as I can possibly
Nice.
Do. But never mind that for that. But that really made me want to write. And then a couple of years later, I read Guy Gavriel Kay's Joan of Arc Tapestry.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry?
That's one of my favorite series of all time, and I very rarely ever meet anyone who knows what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it is a brilliant series. It's three books, The Summer Tree, The Wandering Fire, and The Darkest Road. And Guy Gavriel Kay cut his teeth in writing by being the guy who edited The Silmarillion with Christopher Tolkien.
Oh, wow.
And made sure that it saw light of day. So that's how he got started writing. And then he wrote The Fiona Var Tapestry, and it is exquisite. It is one of the most beautiful things I've ever read. And that was, when I read that, I thought, okay, I knew I wanted to write, now I know who I want to write like. And I spent my early days as a writer trying to emulate Kay and turn my style into something that was as literary and moving as his. And, you know, my work is a pale reflection of what he does, but at least he's been my inspiration for a long time.
And we all do have our heroes. One thing that I actually am wondering, because I read so much writing advice, and I have like my own heroes that I mimic and things like that. But is there a piece of advice that you got that changed the way you look at writing?
Wow. Piece of advice that changed the way I look at writing. Well, when I was in college, I took a writing course. It was the only one I took. I thought when I went to college, I thought I was going to be a creative writing major, and this course cured me of that. it was a workshop course, and it was one of these courses where everybody was in there trying to bash everyone else's work and be as cruel as they could be. And it was a terrible, terrible experience. And the only redeeming thing about the experience was the graduate student who ran the workshop was wonderful. She was as compassionate and helpful as everyone else was not. and one of the things she said to me at one point when I had just gotten comments from people and she could tell I was down, she basically said to me, keep moving forward. Do not retreat into rewrites. She said, if you do that, you will never finish. Writing is momentum. Keep moving forward. And that's probably, to this day, it's along with put your butt in the chair and write, the best piece of advice I've ever gotten.
Right. Mm. So at conventions, the first convention we met you at was a local convention, and one of the things I noticed was a lot of repetition in the questions that were getting asked at every single panel, no matter what the topic was. As a panelist, what kind of questions do you think aspiring writers should avoid asking at panels?
You know, I'm not sure that's a place. I want to go, and here's why.
Mm-hmm.
What sounds, I mean, yes, there is repetition in questions, but by the same token, that doesn't mean that the questions are bad.
Right.
In fact, at times, the questions that are repeated most often are the ones that cut closest to the bone, if you know what I mean.
Right.
I think that there are some questions, things like, where do you get your ideas? Which is such an idiosyncratic question to answer that I'm not sure I can say anything to anyone that's going to be helpful. Ideas come from the damnedest places, and you never know when they're going to crop up, and it's, you know, everybody's creative process is different. But I think that for most of the questions that you hear at a convention, there's at least one author on one panel who's going to look at that question and have something really insightful to say. Now, I don't think every author is going to, but, you know, what Faith might find fascinating to talk about and you know, might be able to offer some incredible nugget of wisdom, I might not have anything to say to at all. It varies from person to person. But I don't think there are bad questions. As someone once said, there are no stupid questions, only stupid people who ask them.
All right. Well, on the opposite side of that coin, are there questions that writers really should be asking, aspiring writers really should be asking?
I think any question that touches on the business of writing those are quite often the questions that are most easily answered in firm terms without resorting to generality, because again, creative processes are so idiosyncratic, they're so individual, that there's only so much I can tell you about what I do every day in front of the computer that's going to be helpful to you, because, you know, each process is different. On the other hand, there's stuff about writing and how one comports oneself when meeting agents or when attending conventions or attending writers' conferences. Those are the types of questions that there really are right and wrong answers to. And there are things that we can tell you that are going to be maybe not so valuable while you're writing your book, but as soon as you turn around and you're ready to start marketing yourself and your work, they're going to be enormously helpful. Does that answer the question?
Yes, it does, certainly.
Yeah, okay.
Now, speaking of the business of writing, I know one of the posts you wrote last year was about how you still believe in traditional publishing, because right now we have a big wave of self-publishing and small press coming out with the advent of the e-books and with the gaining popularity. So would you mind sort of reprising a little bit of what you said about why you still believe in traditional publishing? Because I think on this podcast, we're all of different minds, but I know at least Adrian and I want to be traditionally published.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
The basic point I made, and it's one that we've repeated about magical words quite a bit, is that for authors who are established and who are trying to get their backlist in print or who have projects that are going to be hard to place because they straddle genres or something, self-publishing through electronic books can be a real boon. It can help a lot. For beginning writers, for aspiring writers, it's a very tough road to hoe. And part of the reason is simply financial. When you sign a contract with a traditional publisher, particularly one of the larger publishers, say, you know, Tor or Rock or DAW or EOS or HarperCollins or Penguin, somebody like that, you're going to get an advance. It's not going to be a big advance, but you're going to get an advance. So, you know, say you get an advance of $7,000 for your first book, which is about what the average is. That's money in your pocket. You know, you're going to lose 15% to an agent, or lose is the wrong word, but you're going to pay 15% to an agent. But you're still ending up with a nice chunk of change there. Plus, you have a publisher who is going to do the farm for you. They're going to provide you with a developmental effort who's going to help you get your manuscript in shape so that it's as good as can be when it's published. They're going to provide you with a copy editor who is going to make sure that it doesn't have character or narrative inconsistencies or grammatical problems or anything, or syntactical issues or things of that sort. It's going to provide you with at least one, probably two or three proofreaders who are going to make sure the manuscript is clean before it goes to press. They're going to provide you with an artist who's going to give you cover art. They're going to provide you with a publicist who will do varying amounts of work, but they will do something. They will typeset the book for you. They will distribute the book and make sure it ends up in bookstores. And along the way, they do a host of other things that I'm blanking on right now, but I believe in the post I wrote, I came up with about a dozen. And all of those things have a monetary value. You know, you can't get an editor to do work for you without paying them. And when you start figuring the monetary value of those services, and you add it to the advance that you're getting when signing with a traditional publisher, you find that the e-publishing, self-publishing route actually starts with you $10,000 in the hole from where you'd be if you got a standard advance from a big press publisher. So that's part of it. The other part of it is this. The day that I heard from four books that they wanted to publish my first book was along with the day I got married and the day my two daughters were born, the days my two daughters were born, one of the happiest days of my life. And I just don't see how going through the process without the book being vetted and just paying to have somebody publish your book can possibly have the same emotional payoff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's that emotional payoff that I'm looking for, and also somewhat of the idea of validation.
Oh, absolutely.
Through that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, that's really enlightening. Adrian Scribby, do you have anything, any other questions that you have? I know, David, you're running out of time.
We're doing all right. We have a few more minutes here, so if you guys have more questions, I have time to answer a couple more. I wanted to get in a happy birthday to Scribby.
Oh, thank you.
But I'm not singing. That's as far as I'll go.
That's perfectly fine.
I see how this relationship is. It's like, right. We'll wish you the happy birthday, but there's the line.
Right.
Excellent. We'll guilt him into singing at DragonCon.
So I had a question about short story publishing. I've just finished a short story that I've been trying to figure out how to go about publishing. I was looking around, and there are plenty of independent magazines. And then also there are places like Tor has a website, Tor.com, accepts short story submissions. How would you suggest or recommend as being a good way to begin the short story publishing process if you're trying to get started with short stories rather than novels?
It's a great question. Couple of things to know. One is, just in case some of your listeners are wondering, you do not need an agent to sell a short story. Selling a novel without an agent is really hard. Nobody does agented short stories. So submitting directly with your short fiction is standard practice. So that step is much easier. You don't have to worry about the agent. The best thing to do is to check out a few venues, like Tor.com, like Orson Scott Card's Intergalactic Medicine Show, which is an online magazine edited by Magical Words contributor Edmund Schubert. And, you know, the magazine is Science Fiction and Fantasy, which is edited by Gordon Van Gelder and Asimov's and... you know, there are lots of them for different sorts of stories. And the thing to do to start is to read through some issues of those magazines or online magazines and get a feel for what they seem to like. What sorts of stories do you see? If you're seeing a place is kind of doing a lot of paranormal stuff or ghost stories or things like that, and you're trying to sell a hard science fiction story, that's probably not the best match for your work. If, on the other hand, you're writing hard SF, you should probably keep away from something like Realms of Fantasy, you know? So first is to figure out what your market is. And then once you've figured out your market, you go to the website of the magazine in question. And every magazine, whether it's a print or an online magazine at this point, has a website, and it has what's called a guidelines page. The guidelines page gives you all the information you need to know about how to present your manuscript, your story manuscript, to the editors there. Some want electronic submissions, some want paper submissions. Some want your name on a cover sheet, others want your name just in the top corner of the page. Some want double space with margins a certain way, others want other things. It varies from place to place, and when you're working with these journals and magazines, you need to follow each place's guidelines like it's the law. Do it exactly the way they say to. They are looking for professionals who know how to present their work, and this is a way of showing that you are a professional. And the last thing to remember is, with short story submissions, you do them one venue at a time. There's no you don't do what are called scattershot or shotgun submissions. You don't do a whole bunch at once. You do them one at a time. So you send a single submission to, say, Intergalactic Medicine Show. And then if they buy it, great. And if they reject the story, then you go to the next venue. And you work your way down the list of those venues that you've decided best match your work.
Now, yeah, I actually just sent my story to Intergalactic Medicine Show. So... I should be hearing back in a few months. Here's hoping.
Yeah, and that's a great venue. I sold a short story to IGMS a few years ago, and I have just sold a new thief taker story to them, and I also sold a thief taker short story to tor.com.
Wow.
So I have those two online venues that are going to be coming out with the short stories in the month leading up to the book's release. But those are terrific venues, and I wish you every bit of success. I hope your story is bought by one of them.
Thank you.
Now, as the bane of my existence, I do have a couple of questions about short stories. I'm actually currently taking a short story writing workshop with Kat Rambo, who has published in a lot of short story magazines, and that I'm finding that very helpful. But one of the questions I have for you, because you are the one who told me, learn to write short stories. So I'm following your advice, David. I'm following your advice.
I appreciate that.
Yes. Well, so do I, I'm sure, eventually. Right now I'm cursing your name, but whatever. So my question...
Get in line.
Can't I cut? I'm going to cut in line. So one of my questions is about... I know you just said one of the best pieces of advice you got was moving forward. But I wanted to know what your process is for revising short stories and if/how that's different from your process of revising novels.
I actually find it's a very similar process. The basic steps I take when I'm revising something remain the same across forms. So the first step, I finish writing it and I put it away for as many weeks as I can, giving my time frame for trying to get the thing turned in or published. And so, you know, 4 weeks sometimes, if I can get it to 6 weeks, that's even better. I then, if I wrote it on a screen, I print it out and I read it hard copy and I read it aloud. And those three steps, changing the medium on which I'm looking at the story, reading it aloud versus reading it to myself, and giving myself that time distance, they are all intended to do the same thing, and that is to push the story as far away from the writing experience as possible. Because as long as I'm looking at the story as the person who wrote it, I'm going to gloss over whatever mistakes or problems I've created in the writing of it. The more I can make myself feel like a reader of something that is different from whatever it was I was working on, the more I can create that distance between the writing experience and the reading experience, the better chance I have of catching the things that are going to bother me about the story. And at that point, once I'm reading it through and I've created that distance, I'm looking for all the things that I look for when I'm critiquing my own novels. I'm looking for character inconsistencies and syntactical problems and places where I've relied on those crutches that I use when I don't know what else to say. You know, he smiled, she grinned, he nodded, she shook her head. You know, the little things, it's like, yeah, I write that 1,000 times in the book and I really need to stop.
Yeah, my characters sigh a lot.
Yes, sighing. And you think about it, and, you know, I don't nod nearly as much as my characters do. I don't know where this comes from. You'd think I was a bobblehead doll the way I write my stories.
Maybe in a past life.
Could be. A soulless bobblehead doll. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
But yeah, so that's the process I go through, and it really is the same with a novel or a short story, particularly setting it aside for a time. Reading aloud, I've tried to read an entire novel aloud, and I literally end up hoarse at the end of it, so it's something that's much easier to do with a short story. But I try to treat my short story editing almost like I'm doing a reading at a convention or something. Because I find when I'm doing readings during conventions that I find all sorts of mistakes that I've missed in my editorial process.
Does it make you want to stop reading?
A little bit. You know, the first time I ever did a reading, I was so nervous I didn't know what to read. You know, I was invited to this convention and they said, yes, we're going to put you on some panels. We'd love you to do a reading from some of your work. oh my God, I was so frightened. I'm trying to figure out what am I going to read. So of course I go to my wife, who's supposed to be helpful, right? And I say, so I have to do this reading at the convention, and I don't know what to read. What should I use? And she looks at me deadpan, and she goes, Orson Scott Card's written some good stuff. So I don't ask for her help anymore.
She's made it pretty clear that she's not going to be helpful.
Yeah, I know for me, because when I did do the short stories, I read them out loud to... It's amazing advice. I've never heard it put so well, why we do it, as you just said. I've just sort of done it because it felt right, not because I had any good reason for doing it. But when I write something and when I'm reading it to my husband, he likes to read along with me over my shoulder while I'm reading it out loud, which has been a great help, because as the writer, I will self-edit while I'm reading out loud without even noticing. I will...
Right.
Fix a sentence as I read, etc. And since he's both listening to me read it and reading along, he'll be like, no, wait, you fixed that. And I'm like, wait, fixed what? And he'll be able to point out to me where I've fixed while I was reading and didn't even notice, so I can go back and add those in.
Yeah, and actually, you know, one thing that really can help as well, if you can stand it, and if you're working on a Mac, you can get the computer to read your story to you.
Mm.
And that's really helpful.
Huh.
Because then you're doing exactly what your husband's doing. You're reading, you're looking at it with your eyes while you're listening, and you can see the places where you might gloss over with your eye, but you hear the problem, or vice versa. But I find that incredibly helpful until the voice begins to grate on me.
Right. So, David, I know you have a pretty substantial backlist of stories and short stories, and I don't know if you have a backlist of novels that are currently not on the shelves, but do you have any plans of putting them out as ebooks, like you were talking about earlier?
I actually, Adrian will be interested in this, I have recently gotten back the rights to the Lon Tobin books, and because Tor allowed them to go out of print. And so I am looking at putting them out either as individual volumes or, I mean, they're very long, but with an ebook, you could put them out as an omnibus and have, you know, the Lon Tobin Chronicle in one electronic volume. So I am, yes, I'm looking into that. I also have a couple of novels that I'm not sure how I'm going to place because they're kind of idiosyncratic, but I really love them both, and I'm thinking about trying to self-publish those.
Well, great. Adrian, Scribby, any last questions?
Well, I know some of our readers who were not familiar with your work are probably now chomping at the bit to go out and get all your stuff after this. So what are you currently working on right now? Are you doing a short story or a novel right now? Or are you taking a break?
Right now I am actually doing a proposal for two new novels in the Thief Taker universe. And I'm editing a short story, and I'm getting ready to start writing the next Thief Taker book. And again, the Thief Taker stuff, and hopefully we'll be able to get together at some point again, and you can interview me as D.B. Jackson, and we can talk about Thief Taker some more. But Thief Taker books are historical fantasy set in pre-revolutionary Boston, and the first book comes out this July from Tor. It comes out, actually, they're releasing it just in time for the July 4th holiday. It's coming out July 3rd. And
we got to see the cover art.
It's perfect, so...
Yeah, we got to see the cover art at Dragon Con, and it's gorgeous.
Right. Yeah. I
don't know anything about the writing.
And it's I'm delighted with what they've done with it. They've really just given me beautiful artwork, and the print inside, it kind of looks like old time colonial era print at the beginning of each chapter. I mean, Tor has outdone themselves. It's just beautiful. Mm. So everything right now is kind of geared towards that. So that's the stuff I'm working on. And as I say, I have the two short stories coming out soon. People can go to the D.B. Jackson website, which is www.dbjackson-author.com. There's sample chapters from the first two books in the series there.
And really quick, I don't know if you guys covered this while I was sitting in traffic, but why do you have two names?
I have two names because the stuff that I have written in the past is epic fantasy, and it's that implies a very specific thing. It's multi-strand plots and lots of point of view characters and big sprawling stories that go across several volumes and set in alternative worlds and stuff like that. The Thiefmaker books are really more along the lines of kind of historical urban fantasy. Each one is a standalone mystery with a magical element and a historical element. And so the books are so different that Tor wanted to keep the two names separate. And it's something they call author branding, which mm-hmm. is really not nearly as painful as it sounds. So that's basically the reason for doing it. I kind of have two careers going at once right now, but obviously I'm talking about both at the same time. It's not a big secret or anything, and I'll be attending DragonCon this year actually as D.B. Jackson instead of David B. Coe.
So then was the idea to take the pen name for the Thiefmaker books Tor's recommendation or an idea that you had to try to avoid the cross-genre thing?
It was kind of mutual. I knew I was straying and that I might need to do it under a pseudonym, and we went to Tor with it, and they basically said, yeah, let's do this, but let's do it under a different name. So I had an idea that it was going to happen, and Tor, rather than saying, oh, no, there's no need, kind of said, yeah, that's probably a good idea.
And where did Jackson come from?
My father, who died several years back, was named Jack, so it was very easy to come up.
I see.
Scribe, if you get into short stories, you get to come up with a pen name. Hey.
I already have a pen name.
Well, yes, but I assumed your big fantasy tomes would be under that, so.
No, well, my fantasy books are going to be under Lauren Harris.
Oh.
if I write short stories and other kinds of genres, it will be Lorelai Quinn.
Aww.
Oh, really? Oh, I like that.
I like the sound of that much better than Lauren Harris. I don't really like my name. It doesn't really sound like an author's name.
And how does that make you feel?
Like I failed before I started.
Okay, I think we're in a kind of weird area here now.
Okay. Yeah. So author confession time.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, one more thing you guys should know, because you'll enjoy it. Ed was supposed to post on Magical Words today, but he couldn't get there because he had stuff going on. So today's post was writing advice haikus. So you need to go to Magical Words and write writer's advice haikus.
Oh, God. I'm going to have to do that as soon as I get home. I'm going to be composing them in the car on my way back. I'm currently podcasting from outside of Dunkin' Donuts because I got off work exactly at 6, and I raced to the nearest place with a Wi-Fi connection. So I'm sitting in my car in front of a Dunkin' Donuts podcasting.
I'm nursing my second cup of morning coffee.
Yeah, shut up.
Hey, I had to get up at 7 on a Saturday. Don't start.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like fun. Well, thank you very much for allowing me to do this. This was great fun.
No, it was a pleasure to have you on. I can't wait to have you back on, either as yourself or as D.B. Jackson.
Yes,
well,
maybe
I look forward to that, too.
And maybe next time I will be over being quite so starstruck.
And Scribby won't be late, but let's not count on that.
Yeah, so there's no need to be starstruck with him.
We're good then.
So you just need to come back to the States and you can go to DragonCon with us.
Exactly.
Yes.
So, David, before we sign off, why don't you give our listeners a rundown of all the places you can be found?
All the places I can be found. All right. I'll be at DragonCon August 31st through September 3rd. I'll be literary guest of honor at Constellation in Huntsville, Alabama in October. And I'll be literary guest of honor at MarsCon in Williamsburg, Virginia next January.
Wonderful.
Great. Yeah.
So we'll be seeing you at Con Carolinas and at DragonCon.
Looking forward to that.
Yeah, that should be fun. So... how about online? Where else online can...
I'm sorry. You see, I'm such a Luddite. I was like, oh, you want
you Luddite. No, it's okay. It's okay. I'll just cut this part out.
It's okay. I thought the same thing you did, David.
So,
David B. Coe, Amish writer.
So where on the internets can you be found?
Yes, okay. I can be found at www.davidbco.com. I can be found at David B. Coe on LiveJournal, David B. Coe on Facebook, David B. Coe on Twitter, D.B. Jackson Author on Twitter, D.B. Jackson on Facebook, www.dbjackson-author.com, and magicalwords.net. I'm all over the place.
So
I'm,
there are
I'm kind of an internet slut, actually.
Thanks for listening to this interview episode of Pendragon Variety. Be sure to go check out David's newest release under the D.B. Jackson name, Thief Taker, available at Amazon.com and bookstores near you.
I'm good. I'm very good. I'm all sweaty and gross because I just ran up several flights of stairs and yelled at one of poor Dave's friends because I thought it was Scribe. He drives the same car as I was getting out with my groceries, and as he opened the door, I yelled, I thought we were podcasting. Has it started? Oh, God. And I ran up the stairs. And it wasn't you.